From the Stanley and Dorothy Trulson Lecture Hall in Omaha's Durham Western Heritage Museum, Omaha Public Radio presents a special Women's History Month and Nebraska Statehood Month program on Noon Forum. In an event co-sponsored by the Nebraska Humanities Council entitled Nebraska's Winding Road to Statehood in the Footsteps of a Female Settler, Peru State College History Professor Sarah Brandis Crook will recount the issues of Nebraska's territorial days in the persona of Nebraska settler Barbara K.G. Mayhew Bradway. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Tuesday, March 12, 2008, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Western Heritage Museum, the Nebraska Humanities Council, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Mick Hale, Director of Education at the Durham Western Heritage Museum.
This evening's program is Sarah Crook's interpretation of one of Nebraska's earliest settlers, a woman who faced some of the perils of frontier life, who observed the political struggle of deciding the fate of territory's new capital, and who was associated with the infamous Underground Railroad. Sarah Crook is a professor of political science and history at Peru State College. She has received several honors, including the PEO Scholar Award, the PSC Teaching Excellence Award, the Nebraska State College's Teaching Excellence Award, and the George and Lillian Schottenhamel Honors Chair in the Humanities. One of the programs that she does, along with colleague Dan Holtz, is known as the Trails and Tales Institute and Tour. This coming summer, this program features Plains Indian history and literature. If you're interested, please feel free to visit with Dr. Crook after tonight's performance. She currently also has served 6 years on the Nebraska State Historical Society's Board of Directors, with 2 years as the president of that board. She's also on the Nebraska Humanities Council Board, but her love of Nebraska history and Nebraska politics goes back to her childhood. As a farm girl growing up in a country church and attending a one-room country school in the 1950s and 60s, she developed a deep appreciation for Nebraska and its people, and that continues today. So sit back and let today's speaker take you back in time to the year of 1881. Ladies and gentlemen, I introduce Barbara Ann K.G. Mayhew Bradway.
Goodness, what a large crowd. How lovely. I did tell him that the room I was in just before I came out here, I felt like I was back in the cellar of where I had been as a young mother. My name sounds rather impressive, and part of the story that I will tell you tonight explains my name. I'm not a famous person from Nebraska history, but I'm a person who lived through a very important time in Nebraska history. And as having lived through that time, I can tell you a lot about the character that shaped our state. And so I hope what I have to share with you tonight will give you a little more insight into how Nebraska came to be the state that it is today. I'll start with my maiden name, Barbara Ann Cagey. I was born in Ohio. Don't figure this out, but I was born in Ohio in 1833. So, I was the oldest child born to Abraham and Anna Fansler K.G., and then shortly thereafter, my brother was born. He was 2 years younger than I. And then Mary. And then my mother had Joel, and both she and Joel died. And so, of course, that meant that I then became the oldest child of a motherless home. John and Mary were able to go to school. My father was absent at times. In fact, he came to be known as California Abe because he went to California a few times to try his luck out there. And as such, we grew up kind of sprinkled among relatives and neighbors in Ohio. And one of those neighbors was a family by the name of Mayhew. You're putting two and two together, I can see. And I did marry Alan Mayhew. I was at the ripe old age of 15 when I got married. He was 23, though, and we had known each other for quite some time, obviously family being friends for a long time. And by the time we moved to Nebraska, we already had two young sons. We came here in 54, and some of you are saying, well, that would be right. Because up until 54, Nebraska, what we know today as Nebraska, had been part of that permanent Indian reservation. Kind of takes away the word permanent, don't you think? But, of course, they thought this was the great American desert. Nobody would want to come here. But people like the Mormons, who had settled up just north of here, a little bit further along the Missouri River. Of course, Peter Sarpy was a little bit further south of here. And then there were other sprinklings of settlements in Nebraska and down into what today we would know as Kansas. Fort Riley, Fort Leavenworth, Shawnee Mission, some of those places had white settlers. And so it came to be that they decided that this area needed to be opened to white men, and we would be some of the first whites to come to Nebraska. Part of the reason that this area was to be open to white people had nothing to do with the great agricultural community that we know will develop in Nebraska. And my husband actually was part of that, growing, picking wild grapes, not even growing grapes, but picking wild grapes and turning them into wine. But because there were some political things behind it. Now, mind you, I'm just a woman of the 1850s and 60s. And, of course, we were never allowed to vote. Can't you imagine women having the right to vote? Who knows? Does sound quite bizarre, though, doesn't it? Anyway, I did pay attention to what the men said. And I did, of course, as any good woman would, pay, eavesdrop occasionally and heard what the men were talking about. So one of the things I heard was that there was a senator from back east someplace, a senator from Illinois, I believe was his name, and he owned property in this hamlet that was located along the shores of Lake Michigan. Now, as a U.S. senator from that state and owning property in that region, he thought that if he could get the great permanent Indian reservation, that great American desert, open to white settlement, that then something would go through the center of the country rather than through the southern part of the country. Now, since you're sitting here in a railroad terminal, I would imagine you know what that is. It would be what? Okay, I heard railroad, but you've got to be more specific. Well, and before that, they didn't even know who was going to build it. It was going to be a one-of-a-kind that was going to go Transcontinental Railroad. Now, I'm going to add one more word. The Transcontinental Railroad. Because in the 1840s and 50s, nobody imagined that there would be more than one. It was going to be the Transcontinental Railroad that connected the East with California. Now, as early as the 1840s, there was talk of creating this great American desert into what was then going to be known as the Nebraska Territory. Nebraska meant flat. And of course, in the 1840s, travelers going to Oregon, California, and the Mormons going to Utah had figured out that flat is good. When you're going in a wagon train, flat is very good. Okay? So they began to think that this might be that the Oregon Trail, the Mormon Trail, were paving the way, as it were, for the Transcontinental Railroad. Now, there were Southerners who had much different opinion on this. There were those who thought it should go down through Texas. In fact, you might know, those of you who know your history, that the Gadsden Purchase in what will be, what is right now, for me, the New Mexico Territory, was actually purchased so that they could run the railroad through the Gila River Valley. Of course, Senator Douglas from Illinois had a different idea. His idea was the Platte River Valley. So, one of the positions that he got in the U.S. Senate was he landed the job of committee chairman on the Committee of Territories. Now, starting in 1844, a bill was introduced every year up until it was finally passed 10 years later. Only for the first 9 years, it was called a Congressional Act for the Organization of the Territory of Nebraska. Just Nebraska. Kansas doesn't even come into existence until 1854, when they finally realize, Douglas, in his kind of political strategizing, do I have a politician here tonight? Well, they would know what I was talking about. You know, always working the angles, okay? Well, anyway, he understood that if he had two territories, that then you would have two territorial capitals. Makes sense. And he was afraid if you just created the Nebraska territory out of the great permanent Indian reservation, that that territorial capital might be located a bit further south, and that St. Louis would be the hub. Well, of course, if you have two territories, then you have a second territorial capital. And if you look at Omaha City on a map, we're pretty much tonight dead west of... Oh, you caught on. Yes, almost dead west of Chicago. Senator Douglas knew that. In fact, some of you might know, now I'm a Nebraska Cityan, so realize that there are some wounds that don't heal easily. And some of you may consider Omaha City. Notice you took the name city too. You know what city implied, of course, that you would grow to be a large town. Ask Brownville. Yes. Well, Nebraska City had hoped that they might be the territorial capital. In fact, after the first governor died, did you know that? He got here and died 2 days later. Not a good sign. There's one of the winding roads to statehood, don't you think? First governor dies. The acting territorial governor, a man by the name of Cummings, that name may sound familiar here in the Omaha City area, he had connections to the Council Bluffs, mother of Omaha City, Council Bluffs region, who just happened to donate a building for the territorial capital. And they took a census, and twice as many people were below the Platte as above the Platte. And in fact, once Cummings announced that despite that number, and of course most of those people probably weren't here permanently anyhow, they were just crossing over to be counted so that their side could win. It's pretty common not only here, but you'll see in a little bit, they did that down in Kansas too. They'd cross over the border and then go back. But here in Omaha City, Cummings located the territorial capital, Omaha City. Now, J. Sterling Morton, neighbor of mine, not necessarily a friend of our family, but nevertheless a Nebraska City promoter, he was so mad that he even wrote up a resolution, submitted it to Congress, that everything south of the Platte River should be annexed to Kansas. You're exactly right. Well, Kansas by that time had enough of its own problems. It didn't need to get J. Sterling Morton and the southern half of the Nebraska Territory. Although now I did say southern half, and that is actually not right. When you think of Nebraska today and you think of south of the Platte, the state of Nebraska, that would be approximately half the state, a little less. But when Nebraska was a territory, they made Kansas the 36-30 line up to the 40th parallel. Nebraska went from the 40th parallel how far north? Anybody know? The Nebraska Territory. Say. Past, well, the Dakotas were just the Dakota Territory. So it went all the way to Canada. The Nebraska Territory included all of what today you know as Nebraska, most of the Dakota Territory, most of the Montana Territory, most of the Wyoming Territory, and a corner of what is now the state of Colorado. The size, Nebraska, the state that we have today, is only one-fifth of the original territory. Well, that brings me to my second issue. The railroad was the first issue that Senator Douglas was interested in, but the second issue would be the issue that would cause more concern for myself and my family. Now, Senator Douglas thought the railroad was important, but he also understood that another issue was important. And I'm going to back you up in time here a little bit to a time before even I was born. The year's 1820, and the state of Missouri wants to the area of Missouri wants to become a state. And so they admitted Missouri, but in the process, what did they do? You know it as the Missouri Compromise. Missouri became a slave state, and Maine became... Oh, some of you are good at your American history. Maine became a free state. Why did they do that? They wanted a balance in the U.S. Senate. Same number of slave states as free states. The South had long lost a majority in the House of Representatives because, of course, it's based on population, and they only let the South count their slaves as 3/5 of a person. It's kind of a bizarre concept, isn't it? But anyhow, even with slaves at 3/5 of a person, the South was still being outvoted in the House, but not in the Senate. So they made this deal in 1820, a deal that many of us believed would be kept. And that was not only that they admitted these two states to keep the even balance, but that everything above the 36-30 line would forever bar slavery. Would forever. It's kind of like the permanent Indian reservation, don't you think? No wonder the Indians didn't believe in our language. Anyway, so along comes the year 1850. And in 1850, they were trying to decide about how to add California to the United States. It had been just, you know, flocked with men, basically men. Few women, but we won't talk about them. I am a Christian woman, so we will not talk about them. Anyhow, these men flocking to California. And so they needed to add California as a state. In fact, California never was a territory. It went from being part of Mexico to being the state of California. Never was organized as a territory. Part of the trade-off, and it was a terrible, terrible trade-off, part of the trade-off was that California came in as a free state, but they would strengthen the Fugitive Slave Act. Now, the original Fugitive Slave Act had been passed by the first Congress, and it was kind of a slap on the hand. If you helped a runaway slave escape from their master, that was not a good thing. That was against the law. Well, in 1850, the South said, okay, you can have California as a slave state, or free state, excuse me, but we want some teeth in the Fugitive Slave Act because there's too much Underground Railroad activity taking place. Now, at this point, most of it was back in the Kentucky, Ohio, further east region. So they agreed to it. That was part of the deal, to make the South agree to the Compromise of 1850. But that is part of what set people like my family into action. And that action was to fight against the Fugitive Slave Act and to help runaway slaves. Well, fast forward to the Kansas-Nebraska Act, 1854. And again, they added Kansas, last-minute thing, so they get those two territorial capitals. Douglas also thought, okay, I've solved that one problem. I'm going to make Chicago a big city someday. Seemed to work. But his other issue was slavery, because Senator Douglas not only wanted to be well-respected in Illinois and Chicago, he wanted to be popular nationwide because he had ambition to run for president. So he supported this idea known as popular sovereignty, which is a concept whereby the people of the territory will decide whether to be free or slave. Well, immediately, if you remember, I said the Compromise of 1820 said slavery would be forever banned. Now, all of a sudden, slavery is possible all the way to the Canadian border. In fact, there was a group of men in Ripon, Wisconsin, that actually formed before the ink was even dried on the Kansas-Nebraska Act. They formed a brand new political party. They were so mad that this pledge that they had been promised in 1820 was now being violated that they formed a spanking new party. You might have heard of it. Grand Old Party. Yeah, Grand Old Party. You know the Democratic Party's older, don't you? But yes, the Republican Party was formed in direct response to the Kansas-Nebraska Act. They called the twin evils of society. Now, one's pretty obvious. What evil was that? Slavery. Now, the other evil had to do with the Mormons. The Republican Party took a stand against polygamy as well. But that's a whole nother story. I'm going to stick with the slavery story. So, Nebraska's opened up. My husband and I come. We have two young sons. We get to the Missouri River, and we'd heard stories about the Missouri River. Kind of rambled from bluff to bluff, carved different channels at different times, ripped up trees. You've probably heard stories of steamboats being, the whole idea of a steamboat not making it because getting caught by the trees that were dug up in the torrent. But when we got here and we saw the Missouri River, we understood why some people called it the Hudson of the West. It was beautiful. And on the other side, there were some trees along the riverbanks. But then after that, it was just like a rolling kind of grassy ballroom. It was just beautiful, just kind of flat and flowed out there. We were able to get on a ferry and cross at Nebraska City. Colonel Bull Ward and his son had set up a ferry business there. They, of course, had wanted the territorial capital, which they didn't get. And you see, I keep coming back to that, don't I? Anyway, we came across the river there in Nebraska City, and then we went out southwest of town, about a mile southwest of town, clear outside the boundaries. And actually, at the time, there were kind of like three little towns that eventually all came together as Nebraska City. There was Kearney Hill, Kearney City, Prairie City. They all had the word city in it, all hoping that someday they would be big. And we built our house out on the edge of town. Now, originally, the first year we were in kind of a dugout. In fact, it was probably, if I remember correctly, the beginnings of our caves, kind of dug into the side of the Table Creek Ravine, which is a small little stream that empties into the Missouri River. The following year, though, in 1855, my husband did build us a 14 by 16 cottonwood log structure. Cottonwood was plenty along the riverbanks. And we were most fortunate because you got any further west, and those people spent most of their life in a sod house because that was all that was available if you got away from the rivers. But we had this lovely wood structure. By the way, it still stands. It's mortised at the corners. There's no nails in it. We have two windows on the south side, and then there's a small loft up above where the boys would sleep. And there will be more boys than just the two. And that was our home until 1865. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So we moved there in 1854 into the log structure in 1855, and then we'll move out in 65. But let me tell you a little bit about that time in between. My husband did dig a cave. Now, that cave has become under quite a bit of suspicion. It was a cave that opened into Table Creek, ran underground, and then did have a tunnel that went straight up with a ladder and an opening in plain sight. Now, a lot of people thought that cave was attached to our cabin, that there was some secret hole under our cabin. That is not so. And we used our cave for storing our vegetables and for storing the wine that my husband made from those grapes. Some people have said that slaves stayed in that cave, and that may be. But as the wife, I would never have known those details because, again, the fugitive slave law, what many of us called the Bloodhound Bill, would have never allowed us to have gone free had we been caught. So men did not tell women and children everything, partly because they probably thought we couldn't keep a secret. Imagine that. But partly also because if we knew about it and something was found out, we could go to jail. There was jail time. There was a $1,000 fine. I don't know about you, but I think $1,000 sounds like a lot of money. And so, basically just the men. So were there slaves at our cave? Could be. I do know slaves were in my house. And I'll come to that story in just a little bit. We did endure some tough weather as well. I have heard that you all think you've had a tough winter. That be correct? Well, I do have to tell you that in 1873, and I was living out south in Nebraska City in an area called Camp Creek with my dad at that time. In fact, that's where I currently live. That we had a Easter blizzard in 1873. It snowed for 3 days. And for travelers who, you know, basically a wagon, many of them got caught in ravines, and we dug dead bodies out of the ravines for days after that. So maybe this winter's a little tough, but it's not 1873. And then, of course, the next year. I don't know, any of you remember 1874? No? I thought you looked kind of young. In 1874, a wall of and 8 vegetable gardens till there was nothing left. Locusts, grasshoppers, tough. I do have one story, because I'm going to talk about my brother here in just a little bit. And he came to see us in 1855. He had been, and that was shortly after we'd gotten into our house, he had been back east. He was my younger brother. He had gone back east to teach school. Now, again, we were in Ohio. By back east, I mean western Pennsylvania. Of course, or not Pennsylvania, western Virginia. Today, you would call that West Virginia. But he was teaching back there. And while teaching back there, he became very much enamored with the ability of black people, Negroes. And so he began to talk about how the Negro was just as intelligent as any white man. That did not go over well in Virginia. And so eventually, my uncle had to promise to the people of Virginia they were ready to string him up or tar and feather him, whatever it took to silence him. My uncle intervened and said, if I get him to leave, go out west someplace, will you let him be? And they said, as long as he never comes back to Virginia. Well, he will return to Virginia, and they will get him the second time. But first, I'll tell you what happened out west. He came out west, he and my dad, Abraham, California Abe, came out in 1855, stayed with us for a while. And in fact, my sister was still back in Ohio at the time, and he wrote, and I can't read it all because, of course, my arms aren't long enough anymore, and the paper is a little yellowed because this is dated December 24th, 1855. And he wrote Mary, and he's talking about that the farmers aren't taking the corn and feeding it to cattle. They're just cutting off the stalk and shipping it down the river. He also goes on to talk about how a Rocky Mountain bear came into Nebraska City in the winter of 1855 and was shot and killed in Nebraska City. He also talked about how wolves were plenty, that all you had to do is get about a mile outside of town, and we were pretty close to the edge of town, and you could see packs of wolves, and that people would go out and shoot them and eat them, of course. And right at the beginning, or at the end, excuse me, and it is Christmas Eve, and he writes this, and he says, "There are prairie chicken aplenty. In fact, I'm going out to kill a dozen or more for tomorrow's Christmas supper. Affectionately yours, John Kagi." So lots of wildlife out here. Somebody asked me this afternoon if we ever saw Indians. And we did see some Indians. They were pretty common. And they would come up. Now, we were never really afraid of them. Maybe initially you were a little concerned. They were more curious than anything. They'd just peer right in your window like there was nothing there. And then if you had something that they wanted and they could see it, then they'd just come take it. So we began to learn that if we knew Indians were in the area, we'd leave out something we didn't care if we lost and make sure all the good stuff was hid. Because if you gave them something, then they were satisfied and away they'd go. So never really too scary. There were some incidences during the Civil War, but most of those were further west. Right here along the Missouri River, we felt pretty safe. But now let me turn to the issue I want to talk about tonight, and that's the issue of slavery. When my brother John got out here to Nebraska and lived with us for a while, he did study law. And then he found that there was a lot going on down in Kansas. He'd met up with Jim Lane. Anybody heard of the Jim Lane Trail? The Jim Lane Trail. Jim Lane would figure out that it was easier to get free soil people into Nebraska and Kansas if you came through Iowa. Because there for a while they were trying to come across Missouri on the Missouri River, because steamship travel was the way to travel. But those bushwhackers, do you know what I mean by a bushwhacker? It's those no-good pro-slaveryites in Missouri. We call them bushwhackers. They just came out of nowhere, and they would capture these ships. They would throw stuff overboard. They'd not necessarily drown people, but they'd make them get off. And then they'd sink the ship. And these people would lose all their belongings. And so the free slave people realized that to get into Kansas, you couldn't come across Missouri anymore. Missouri didn't want you if you were a free soil person, because they wanted Kansas to come in as slave state. In fact, for a while, some of you may know this about Kansas history, there were two governments running in Kansas, one a free soil government, one a pro-slavery government, both claiming to be the legitimate government. In fact, Lawrence, Kansas, it was a free soil town. In fact, I'd go even so far to say it was a hardcore abolitionist town. And those bushwhackers out of Missouri came in to Lawrence and killed every man, some young children as well, mainly boys, and burned the whole town up. Didn't stop Lawrence. They built right back up. In fact, there was a hotel called the Free State Hotel, and he said, every time they burn it down, I'm just going to build it a story higher. And so he did. The next time, it was a three-story Free State Hotel. They burned that one down in 62 during the Civil War. Now it's four stories high, and they made it a brick. But anyway, my brother heard about all this commotion down there, and he wasn't happy with Nebraska City either. Did you know that Nebraska City had slaves? The state of Nebraska had slaves. In fact, in the 1860 census, there were 12 slaves in the state of Nebraska. The Nebraska legislature just couldn't come to the point where they would, a territorial legislature, outlaw slavery. We didn't outlaw slavery here in the territory until 1861. Kind of sad, don't you think? In fact, in Kansas, when they did the 1860 census, they had no slaves in Kansas. Nebraska had 12. In fact, Judge Holly was his name, a judge in Nebraska City. In 1859, he had two slaves, Uncle Hercules and Aunt Dinah, and he sold them on auction, Main Street of Nebraska City. Can you believe that? Had slave auction in Nebraska City. Those were the types of things that galled my brother and incensed our whole family. Well, so my brother did go down into Kansas to see what he could do. While down there, he became a writer, set editorials back east. In fact, you can go look them up. They have them in the archives. He wrote for the New York Tribune. He wrote for local papers down in Kansas, obviously. Lawrence went by the name Republican. That makes sense. He wrote for the Cincinnati paper. He wrote for a Chicago paper. He sent editorials back east telling them of the atrocities that were occurring in the Kansas and Nebraska region and how those bushwhackers were attacking people in Kansas. In fact, I was sharing this story earlier tonight that most of you probably don't know. There was a young family that came to Kansas in the late 1850s, and the father, he was a free soiler, not a hardcore abolitionist, but a man who believed Kansas should be a free state. And while there, he was injured by one of these groups of bushwhackers that came in from Missouri. Every time they had a vote in Kansas, these bushwhackers just came like crazy over into Kansas and voted, and then went home to Missouri. Well, anyway, this young family, the father was injured, and he lingered a while, but within a year or so, he died and left his family with the mother and several young children, the oldest of which was a young man by the name of Will, who was only 11 years old. And so at age 11, he became the man of the house, so to speak. Will met up with the Mr. Russell, who started the Pony Express. And then eventually, and he rode the Pony Express. I don't know if you ever saw any of those ads. Did any of you ever apply for the Pony Express? I thought maybe a couple of you over here might have remembered those, but maybe you're not that old. Anyway, he applied for the Pony Express because it said right there on the ad, orphans preferred. Makes you think, doesn't it? Well, anyhow, he did ride with the Pony Express, and then he did hook up with Russell Majors in Waddell, the big freighting firm that had the government contract. Government contracts have always been lucrative. And he worked for them for a while. And his name was Will. And I'll bet you know who he is. You just haven't figured it out yet. Will Cody. Buffalo Bill Cody. That was the man. And his father had died as a result of Bleeding Kansas. Well, my brother goes down to Bleeding Kansas. He meets up with John Brown. Now, I assume most of you know who John Brown is. My brother did not meet John Brown until after the Pottawatomie Massacre, so my brother was not involved in that. And John Brown will tell you, he never shot anybody. He did teach the boys the business, but John Brown himself never shot anybody. My brother would meet up with him. In fact, he wrote us back and came up and talked to us. By this time, my sister had moved out here, and my father and she moved out to Camp Creek, out south of Nebraska City. It's kind of a little settlement area. There was a church and a school, and eventually a cemetery. In fact, my sister is buried in that cemetery. And they lived south of town. John came back and told him that he was going to join John Brown's Provisional Army. Now, they didn't want to overthrow the U.S. government, as some would have you believe. They just wanted to bring an end to slavery. They thought the Bloodhound Bill, as we knew that Fugitive Slave Act, was the most evil thing Congress had ever done. And so he worked with John Brown to help get slaves out of Missouri. Now, you may say, why didn't they just go straight north into Iowa? Iowa's a free state. Too much guard going on there. It was easier to slip them into Kansas, go to that abolitionist town of Lawrence, and then from there, Topeka was very sympathetic, and then you headed north. Now, let me back up to, I told you about Jim Lane, and I never finished Jim Lane's trail. This was the man who realized that you could bring free soilers into Kansas, not across Missouri, because we told you couldn't do that. They bushwhackers would get you. So he came up with this trail across southern Iowa, and then it crossed the Missouri River near Tabor, Iowa. Tabor was full of Congregationalists. Congregationalists who believed slavery to be as evil as my family did. Then they'd cross over the Missouri River just north of Nebraska City, and then kind of skirt to the north and west of Nebraska City, because there were people in Nebraska City who favored slavery, including J. Sterling Morton. And come west of Nebraska City, near to our house, then they'd go down through Camp Creek, down where my father lived, down on into Peru. I believe they built a college there. I know they built a college there. Still there, too. Then down on, you had to stay west of Brownville, because Brownville was a pro-slavery town in Nebraska. Mr. Brown, for whom the town was named, even owned slaves. So you had to stay west of Brownville. But then Nemaha City, one of those other towns that thought they'd be a big city someday, Nemaha City had a family there by the name of Russell, a Houston Russell that was sympathetic. And then Jim Lane went on further south, but again he had to stay west of Rulo, because Rulo, Nebraska, was pro-slavery. So he actually founded a new town. Some of you might know this town. In fact, they wanted to call it Lanesville, and he was like, no, no, no. But he camped on this high spot that overlooked the Nemaha River Valley. And it's not called Lanesville. It's called, do you know? Southeast Nebraska, west of Rulo. Falls City. Falls City. In fact, there isn't a street called Lane Street for Jim Lane. Now, originally this was the route for bringing free soilers into Kansas, but it also became the basic route for bringing slaves out of Missouri, Kansas. So it was like a little corner elbow. He'd come out from Missouri to Kansas to Nebraska, back into Iowa. And then crossed Iowa, free state, and on into Illinois and Michigan and up into Canada, where they'd be safe. Well, now I do have to tell you, this was not like a cattle trail. It wasn't a spot where they walked every step. In fact, it was more of kind of a web of places. Because you couldn't always go to the same place or they'd be there waiting for you. In fact, I imagine toward the end, there were very few blacks who stayed in our cave, runaway slaves, because we were the abolitionist whole of Nebraska City. They were always looking for them there. But the last group that my brother brought out of Missouri, Kansas, Missouri, was in the winter of 58-59. In fact, in December of 58, my brother had been involved in an episode down in Fort Scott, Kansas, right down there along the Missouri border. And they were trying to free a man that the deputy marshal had locked up. And the deputy marshal started shooting at him, and my brother was hit, wounded, so he shot back, killed the marshal dead. There was a $3,000 fine out. Award out for my brother's arrest. Well, shortly after that, he met up with John Brown, who had been over in Missouri, who had gathered 11 runaway slaves. In the process, he had stole some horses, and for some, you know what, horse stealers. So there were some people who were a little upset with John Brown. I'll mention that in just a little bit. So he stole some horses and got these 11 runaway slaves. My brother met up with him around the Lawrence area, and a group of them brought this group of runaway slaves. In fact, in route, one of the women had a child. So that brought the number to 12, and they named the child John Brown. And John Brown was their savior. So they get them to Lawrence, and then Topeka, and then Houlton, Kansas, and then up to Falls City. And then they were trying to find, what we understand, they were trying to find Houston Russell's house north of Nemaha City, and they couldn't find it. And they actually stopped at a neighbor's house and asked, is this the Houston Russell house? And the neighbor said, no, it's not. I'm from Tennessee. Ooh. So they went on, but the Tennessean didn't follow them, and they ended up stopping at Squire Kennedy's house. Now, Squire Kennedy lived just west of Brownville, because they knew to stay away from Brownville. And Squire Kennedy gave John Brown a little bit of his thoughts. He told John Brown, I like what you're doing. I just don't like how you're doing it, particularly stealing horses. So don't be coming here anymore because I don't help horse thieves. That was not a good thing. So they stayed overnight there, and from there they probably went on up to Camp Creek. Anyhow, my brother arrived at our house early in February of 1859. Now, I never saw John Brown, but then again, my husband probably made sure I never saw John Brown. But I do know that my brother stayed with us one evening. I think it was February 3rd, if I remember. That's a few years back. But it was 1859. My brother stayed with us. And the next morning, a group of slaves came to the house for breakfast. And they had just left when my brother was still there when a posse showed up at our house, about 50 of them strong from the Nebraska City area. And they called out for my brother to come out. So my husband, Alan, came out. And he said, he's in there, you're right, but so are my wife and children. And by that time, we had 5 boys. And he said, let me get my wife and children out, and then you can have him. But no, he's got a rifle, and we all know he's a good shot. So the wife, myself, and the children come out. But in the meantime, my brother was able to sneak away. And when they entered the house, no one was there. They were not very happy about that. But that was the last group that John Brown and my brother John Cagey would bring out of Missouri. In fact, it was shortly thereafter that we would get this letter. I shouldn't say shortly, because that was February, and this letter would come in September. But some of you might know, I have several letters. This one was dated September 29th, 1859. So that in a very few days we shall commence. We didn't know what he was talking about. He just kept referring to it. You may even hear of it before you get this letter. Things could not be more cheerful or certain of success than they are. We have worked hard. We have suffered much. But the hardest part is now done, and a glorious success is in sight. And then he goes on in the letter to ask Mary to write him. But he said, you can't say John Cagey because people knew John Cagey. By the way, John Cagey was second in command in John Brown's Provisional Army. He's only 24 and a half years old. He's one of the youngest men, but he's also one of the smartest. In fact, they called him the Horace Greeley of the John Brown Party. Anyhow, he tells Mary, if you write, he said, write HK on the outside for Henry Cagey. Henry was his middle name, John Henry. Put them in another envelope and mail it to a Mrs. Mary W. Rittner of Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. Let no one else know but you where the letters are to be sent. This would be our last letter that we would get from him. And even then, he ends, be cheerful, my dear father and sisters. Don't imagine dangers, and all will be well. Affectionately, your brother. This is about 2 weeks later. The whole world knew where my brother was. He and one other man were the first to enter at Harper's Ferry. Their job was to take Hall's rifle factory, surround it, keep it, because John Brown's army was hoping to come in and to take control of that federal arsenal, and then the hope was that blacks would rise up and come join them, and there would be a taking over and a setting free of the slaves. Well, you all know that didn't happen. my brother was among the first to be killed. He was shot in the Shenandoah River. They dragged his body back in along the edge there, and they just dug a hole in the side of the river. And they tell us that a couple days later, the dogs and everything else was digging them up. And now, I know that's really maybe not a nice thing to say, but it sets the tone and the temper of this time. People felt very strongly one way or the other and were willing to die for that, as my brother died for that. We hope that someday his remains will be buried with John Brown's family site. As of right now, the state of Virginia still has my brother's remains. They have not yet turned them over. Well, meanwhile, of course, you do know that much of this will lead to the Civil War. In fact, some have said that the Kansas-Nebraska Act is the first shots of the Civil War. Had all this not happened out here, maybe we'd have found a different way to end the whole slavery issue. But when they opened up this territory to slavery, there were people who couldn't stand it any longer. People like my brother, John Cagey. Meanwhile, my husband left in 1862 to go out west freighting, and he didn't come back. Was kind of a tough time. We thought maybe Indians, because they were a little upset during the war. In fact, if you think about it, the Railroad Act, the Homestead Act, the Morrill Land Grant Act all got passed in 1862 because the South wasn't there to veto it or vote it down. They didn't have a veto, but to vote it down in the Senate. So all those things got passed that year, and the railroad was making the Indians very skittish. But it turned out my husband died of a disease, didn't hear about it for several years, didn't get word back. There I was. Mother, I had six boys by that time. We'd lost one boy and one daughter. And four of them were under the age of seven. Didn't have any way to make any money. Eventually, I'd marry a man by the name of Calvin Bradway. Hence the last name. He too had been an Underground Railroad conductor over by Red Oak, Iowa, had a cave in his pasture. We were married in 65, moved over there, shot in the back he was in 1869. Some wounds don't heal even though the Civil War was over. And so, I am lucky though. My father took us in. By that time, Calvin Bradway and I had had three children, a daughter who died, and two boys. I had 11 children. No wonder I don't feel very thin. 11 children. Some of them were grown by then, by 1869. But in 1869, my father, California Abe, invited us to come live with him. So we now live in Camp Creek, a little settlement south of Nebraska City. He's a fine man. Been very instrumental in that community. One of those people that helped Nebraska on its winding road to statehood. Now, there are other stories I could tell you. Stories about, you know, the taking the territorial capital and locating the new state capital in Lincoln. I imagine you all probably have heard that story. But it's a good story. It's a true story, too. And, of course, there's other weather stories I could tell you that might make you feel better about this winter. But I think I'll save those for another time. I hope you've enjoyed the stories of my family and how we were part of those early years here in Nebraska. And now I close with this thought. We must not cast our eyes in the past, but lift them from the present and look to the future. Thank you for coming.
You've been listening to a special program on Noon Forum. We've heard a program entitled Nebraska's Winding Road to Statehood, in the Footsteps of a Female Settler. Peru State College history professor Sarah Brandis Crook, in the persona of Nebraska settler Barbara K.G. Mayhew Bradway, has recounted the issues of Nebraska's territorial days. This program was co-sponsored by the Nebraska Humanities Council and presented as part of the Durham Western Heritage Museum's lecture series. It was recorded by KIOS-FM on Tuesday, March 12, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Shauna Forsberg, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Western Heritage Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The next Durham Western Heritage Museum lecture will be Tuesday evening, March 18th at 6:30. At that time, in an event co-sponsored by the Kansas Humanities Council, Bill Worley from the University of Missouri at Kansas City will present a program entitled James Nesmith, Inventor of Basketball. More information on this and other lectures in the series can be found at dwhm.org. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.